Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. HubSpot has been a huge supporter of the show. They have so many tools that can help your business. The one that I want to just mention today, so you go check it out, is their new AI chatbot. It's called Campaign Assistant, and it's a totally free-to-use AI tool made for marketers and business leaders who spend hours a day on content creation. Campaign Assistant will transform the way you build marketing campaigns at scale. Craft personalized emails, ads, and landing pages in a matter of minutes. Just pick the content type, add key selling points, and let AI take it from there. It works seamlessly with all of HubSpot's marketing and sales tools to scale your output across email, social, and more. So AI your way to your most effective campaigns yet at HubSpot.com/campaign-assistant.
I first got interested in investigative journalism as a product of being a news junkie. I thought journalism sounded like a fascinating line of work to be in, and I was fortunate enough to get to intern and later work for a small wire service based in out of their DC bureau called Interpress Service. Part of my job there was to cover think tanks, which sounds incredibly boring and wonky, and I guess aspects of it are. And the thing that maybe I was bored at a lot of these events, and I started to look around and see that, you know, the buildings that these think tanks were in were really nice, and they had a lot of expensive catered food, and they seemed to be paying a lot of their employees a lot of money. And they had the names of billionaires and major Fortune 500 corporations on plaques and naming their conference centers after companies and individuals with a lot of resources. And I started to wonder, what's the economics of all this? How is this all put together? And I quickly learned that that's not a question you're really supposed to ask. You're just sort of supposed to swim in that, you know, in that golden trough or whatever it is, and enjoy the perks and not ask too many questions about how all of this is put together and maybe even whose interests are being represented.
And if you can, just describe what a think tank is for people who don't quite understand that concept, because people may not have ever experienced this before or really understood how this world
works. So one interesting thing about think tanks that people always assume is, first of all, that there is a definition and that there is such a legal thing as a think tank. There is no such thing as the legal entity of a think tank. But a lot of research institutions in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, usually in capitals around the world, are independent entities that conduct policy research. And to be clear, the audience, the intended audience for this research is really generally not the general public. It's policymakers. And that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. I work at a think tank now. I will defend that. But it's not academic research. You're doing it because you're trying to come up with policy solutions for policymakers to implement. So it's a way that one tries to inject ideas and policies into the policymaking process.
Okay, no, that makes sense. Okay, so sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your story. I just wanted to understand
absolutely
what that was.
The more I started looking at it, and I was, you know, reporting on foreign policy, and I could very clearly see that a number of institutions in Washington, D.C., where I was, were, had a very outsized influence in the foreign policy debate. They seemed to be generating a lot of the analysis and policy proposals and would then appear before Congress as witnesses that were clearly being implemented as policy. And I started to report more and more on who was funding these entities and who was trying to shape the foreign policy debate. And I think the thing that I always come back to with the foreign policy debate is that, you know, people think of it as very exotic, that foreign policy is maybe above normal politics in some ways, you know, politics ends at the water's edge or something.
Very complex.
And the more I looked at it, the more I was realizing, you know, it's not that, it's not different than any other contested policy space, at least in American politics and probably in contested politics anywhere in the world. You know, that there's interests, there's private interests, there's public interests, there's foreign interests, and they're all competing. The only difference is that we don't talk about it. We don't talk about it in the same way. We pretend that this is somehow just a very fair and pure competition of ideas and that everybody wants the same outcome. And if you walked into a room where you had people, let's say, abortion or same-sex marriage or environmental protection of people who are on opposite ends of the debate and said, hey, guys, I assume you all want the same outcome, they would laugh at you.
Of course. Yeah.
Silly and disingenuous place to start the discussion, right? You guys want different outcomes. It's okay.
Right.
It's all right.
Yeah, exactly. But that's how it works. So I guess the whole point is, you know, you hope that the policy decisions that are implemented are done by somebody that represents you and represents your country, and you feel that they're, you know, they've reached a level in their aptitude that they can make those smart decisions. And I think everybody understands that there's going to be money that are funding opposing ideas constantly. You just hope that there's enough money funding both sides, and then you come to an educated idea after the data and the facts are presented.
Exactly. And I think part of that is to, you know, and again, in other policy spaces, I think we talk about it very openly, that there's dark money, there's influences, people want different outcomes. We have a pretty good conversation about that. And in foreign policy, I don't think that we do. And I think it's really, you know, it's harmful to the United States and probably to other countries as well, that we aren't having, you know, a more honest conversation about the fact that this is a debate that has people that want different outcomes. And some of those interests are, you know, serving a very narrow group of people or even other countries. And, you know, that's okay, but we should at least be having a conversation about it.
And that's sort of prompted your career path. That's why you started to focus on some of these foreign policy focused think tanks. So you have on both sides people putting money into, and what are they trying to solve for? Like, obviously, foreign policy is immense and massive. So there must be some topics that are probably more prevalent than others, or is it just there's a think tank for literally every conversation, every different problem that's being trying to solve that the U.S. wants to have a hand in at least influencing some way?
Well, you know, I think that the diversity of think tanks and of ideas inside the Beltway, for you know, to narrow the scope a little bit, it's far more limited than most people would think. And this kind of goes back to my area of interest and my area of reporting, that, you know, there really is something called the so-called blob, which is what Benjamin Rhodes referred to as the you know, sort of the foreign policy establishment. And excuse me, it's politicians, but it's a lot of people who are these analysts at think tanks, and they sort of police what are the acceptable policy lines to take? What are the acceptable objectives that we're trying to pursue? And the more closely I look at it, the more I've seen, and I've written about this extensively, that it's also kind of the same set of funders throughout. Mm-hmm. You know, the weapons companies are major funders of think tanks that work on foreign policy. So are a small set of foreign countries, the United Arab Emirates, Taiwan, Norway, Japan, are some of the big foreign funders of think tanks. And they don't just fund one think tank. They don't just fund progressive or liberal think tanks or a conservative think tank. They'll want to fund across the spectrum. And I don't think it's that big of a coincidence then that you don't see an enormous array of policy ideas coming out, let alone policies that may question the U.S. relationship with, let's say, autocratic countries like the United Arab Emirates, or serious questioning of the size of the defense budget, or about whether we need certain weapon systems that are incredibly expensive. Those are the types of conversations that it seems like the conversation around that is very constrained.
Interesting. So it's almost like if you have certain entities that fund both sides, then you're never going to have a discussion around a certain policy that could actually negatively impact that entity. But you're going to have seemingly a perceived unbiased view or an unbiased donation towards think tanks, because it seems like, well, we're funding progressive, liberal, and conservative and Republican ideas. So how can you say that we've ever been biased?
Exactly.
Because they're funding both sides.
Okay, but then there's this.
I love wrapping my head around this because this is net new to me. So I'm like complete layman.
There's this interesting quality here that, you know, is, you know, in journalism or in academia, there's kind of some rudimentary concepts of conflict of interest avoidance. You know, which are common sense stuff. Like, you know, let's say one of your funders may stand to benefit from the work that you're doing or the argument you're making. You would proactively disclose that. And, you know, academic journals talk about doing it. Newspapers talk about this. It doesn't mean you can't publish it. It doesn't mean you can't make that argument. It doesn't even mean that there's anything corrupt going on. It just means that to protect yourself, you proactively say, hey, you know, there's this financial link over here. And that's usually considered a very positive, but also a common sense thing. It basically doesn't exist in Washington. And I've looked very closely at it and sort of in the foreign policy realm. You know, regularly you'll see think tanks publishing materials that are beneficial to, let's say, one of their foreign government funders that's urging closer relations between the United States and that country. It doesn't mean it's a bad argument. It doesn't mean it's wrong. But there is something deeply flawed with a set of standards that seem to say that you don't need to disclose a potential conflict of interest like that. And that obviously extends in a major way to the weapons companies that are funding a lot of the foreign policy research in Washington.
And candidly, like, I'm just thinking through, like, the reason why this would be why you protect yourself is because if this ever came to light, then obviously your argument or your policy is discredited immediately. But you're saying the issue is that there's not enough conversation, so this stuff doesn't really come to light.
Exactly. Yeah, you're a couple steps ahead of me there. Yeah, the fact is, okay, the conversation isn't there, the scrutiny isn't there, and as a result, some simple standards that that are really, really, you know, rudimentary and that people get their heads around in academia or in journalism just don't exist. They get thrown out the window. You know, I asked a major think tank without naming names here. I've a couple times asked them because I've seen them doing things that are beneficial to their funders. And I've said, do you guys have a conflict of interest policy? They said, yeah, absolutely. And I said, well, can I see it? And they said, yeah, sure, we'll send it over. And they send it over. And it's a really good in-depth policy dictating how to avoid conflicts of interest between outside work and work being done for the think tank by employees of the think tank. But it never crossed their minds that there could be a potential conflict of interest between the funders of the think tank and the work that they're producing. I mean, it's kind of amazing that they were several steps ahead and they hadn't even thought about a more rudimentary one.
So this is your passion. This is what you've gotten. And so when you start to go into this world, where do you decide to spend your time? What drives you to look at one thing versus another? And also, how do you immerse yourself in this world so that you can investigate on something that seems to be that seems to have no discussion around it?
Well, I think that's a large part of it. And having, frankly, a lot of people who help flag these things to me, you know, and say, hey, there's something interesting going on here. Because I don't pretend to be an expert, let's say, on, you know, the debate over the how or if there should be an end to the Korean War. But, you know, people have assisted me in being like, hey, there's something going on here. There seems to be, you know, a flood of money that is pushing, you know, in a certain direction and no one's talking about it. And I am amazed by how often that happens. You know, normally if there was, you know, a massive sort of dark money, for lack of a better term, campaign towards a contested policy issue, there would be you know, some questions and other investigative journalists would dig into it. And I think in foreign policy, again, it's sort of seen as elite. It's seen as also maybe not something that it's expected that everyday people are supposed to be paying attention to or engaged with. And I think just a lot more flies under the radar, for lack of a better term. And as an investigative journalist, the crudest way of putting it, but I think it is also true, is that it is a very target-rich environment because there's not that many people covering it with a high degree of scrutiny. And as a result, people act in incredibly brazen ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did you, that makes, it's unfortunate. It's not right, but it's not unexpected, I guess.
Yeah.
One's looking at it.
Yeah, exactly. It's, there's a push pull to this. You know, when there's more scrutiny, I think people generally behave better. when there's less scrutiny, they don't have to think about it. It's not even that they go out there saying, I want to do things unethically, but you just don't have to put a lot of
thought. They don't give it a second thought.
Yeah.
They don't give it, at best, they don't give it a second thought. At worst, they do purposely act unethically and knowingly. But yeah, that's sort of the gamut of an unscrutinized and heavily financed arena. Like that's so as you okay. So as you go into this this particular story, what was the point that sort of pushed you, or the information, or the lack of a better word, I'm not a journalist, so the tip that pointed you in this direction to start to look more into this?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that there was sort of the first step to be, there was definitely a first step here, which is that I had colleagues that were flagging that there was this really expensive ad campaign, or what appeared to be very expensive, involving, you know, video billboards in Times Square and newspaper advertisements attacking, the Korean president, Moon Jae-in, and the members of the U.S. Congress who had been trying to, in the case of President Moon, he'd been, you know, talking about sort of what end of Korean War may look like. And in the case of the U.S. Congress, it was some very specific legislation, H.R. 3446, and I think it was another one, 826, which were pretty innocuous pieces of legislation. That's what really jumped out. This was proposed legislation that would have, like, one of them would have essentially asked the State Department to explore what end of war situation might look like. You know, explore, you know, what diplomatic engagement with North Korea in pursuit of a binding peace agreement is what the language that it used would look like. You know, that's all. Sort of explore that. Something that it's a 70-year war. Why are we not pursuing it? It makes perfectly good sense. There's 30,000 Americans still deployed in South Korea, mostly to the DMZ. Why not pursue that? The other legislation was even more innocuous. It was called the Divided Family Reunification Act. And it just essentially said the United States government should prioritize efforts to for there to be meetings between Korean Americans and their family members in North Korea, potentially just over video, you know, via Zoom or something. Stuff that I can't imagine really finding this to be at all offensive. And as I looked at this story, I was like, well, you know, who would possibly put in Times Square billboards about this?
Someone who's pretty passionate.
Somebody's pretty passionate. This particular topic. Money. Yeah. And what is this? And then the next two steps really made me really think I was on that there was something here, which was seeing that, well, for starters, it was there were sort of two sponsors of this. One was called the One Korea Network, which I had never heard of before. And I went and looked, and they have this website, and it's just chock full of conspiracy theories. A lot of them attacking sort of leftists in South Korea, but also being very, very, very pro-Trump, attacking people on the left in the United States, and promoting election conspiracy theories, both in South Korea and in the United States. And the other co-sponsor was something called KCPAC, which was the Korean Conservative Political Action Conference, which was an offshoot of a very well-known conservative group here in the United States called CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which holds an annual conference in Washington. I was like, well, why is there a Korean version of this? And then the more I sort of dug into this, the more it became clear that, you know, all of this came back to one woman who had founded both One Korea Network, and I think it was the chair of both One Korea Network and of KCPAC, and her name was Annie M.H. Chan. She was a very, very wealthy woman living in Honolulu who had bought and sold very expensive properties in Hawaii as well as in California. And she and her then husband back in California had over the past several decades been in and out of various technology related businesses and had clearly accumulated, you know, a fortune that runs into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And okay, that's interesting, but I was like, clearly, you know, she must not. Maybe she just sort of is in the background here.
It's still not adding up, though. I'm sure there's like a thread that runs between all this, but it still doesn't make sense to me why, because you know, you said KCPAC and CPAC and right wing and somebody's associated with conspiracy theories. It still doesn't make sense to me, and you'll get to that, I'm sure, in a second. How this all ties back to like North Korea, South Korea, and bills that really don't do anything net negative for anyone. Like, it's all net positive. Like, I don't understand why somebody on the right or the left would be against Zoom calls with family members. It doesn't make sense, right?
Well, first I'll give you the most sort of innocent, innocuous explanation, which is I actually think that she genuinely believes this stuff. You know, I've seen a letter that she wrote to Donald Trump. I've seen things she signed on to, reports she signed on to that, you know, she very much believes that there is a vast conspiracy involving Chinese and North Korean agents inside the United States and in South Korea who are perpetrating acts of election fraud to fundamentally undermine both South Korea and the United States so they can be overrun by the Chinese and the North Koreans, which, I mean, I guess one's entitled to hold that view. I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support it. The thing that things get a little more concerning when I started to look at some of her business interests, and she was involved in something called IP3 International, which was a civilian nuclear firm based here in the United States that was involved a few years ago in a rather sketchy effort to try to export sensitive civilian nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia. It was blocked. It was a scandal. Mike Flynn was involved. And they had pivoted since then towards trying to build up a business, continuing to export civilian nuclear technology, but justifying the proliferation of these small reactors on the basis that if they're that in a world with great power competition, where the United States is challenged by China and Russia, that energy is going to be a component of this competition. And the only way to compete is to approve the export of these sensitive technologies to Europe and to the Middle East. Technologies which, incidentally, South Korea has quite a bit of as well. And they were going to do this in partnership with South Korean nuclear power firms. So there is a profit dimension to what she was doing, or at least it appears that way, where she was saying, you know, the Chinese are coming to get us, the North Koreans are coming to get us. And at one level, it's, you know, this is purely philanthropic, her interests, and she's funding a news outlet that's publishing, you know, basically fake news, just outlandish conspiracy theories about the elections. She's publishing reports alongside really conspiracy theory oriented organizations in Washington that were talking about election fraud in the 2020 election that, again, are totally baseless. And in the other, over here, then she's engaged in being involved in a company that says it's going to profit effectively from great power competition in the world. So it sort of is like the ugly underside of when people talk about great power competition, when people talk about, approving the export of nuclear technologies for that purpose. You know, you don't get there without making people afraid. Maybe you don't get there organically to have that type of a hostile relationship between countries. Maybe it needs a little bit of a nudge.
It's funny, though.
And that's where I see what she was doing, and I think it's kind of sinister.
It is sinister. And I'm just curious why it feels like there's a need to do this, because I don't think the average American has a positive view of North Korea anyways. But I feel like this is actually instigating fear in an incorrect way. Like, I feel like the actual things that she's campaigning against, those have nothing to do with North Korea and their policies. And I feel like North Korea really doesn't have any ability to significantly impact the U.S. in any meaningful way at all. But I mean, like, nobody looks at North Korea and is like, oh, that's a place that I'd want to go on a trip, right? Like, no, they haven't really done a lot of great stuff for themselves. But still, to do that is just hurting. It's instigating fear. It's creating fear. It's hurting people that those bills are actually trying to help, which are the people that are actually living in North Korea that are not the bad guys in North Korea. They're just the families that are there trying to live their life.
Right. Well, I mean, I think in a sense, the uphill battle that she is fighting is even harder than what you just portrayed. Now, I agree. Most Americans don't wake up and say, you know, wow, I'm really concerned that the North Koreans are coming to get me. Or I believe that North Korea and the Chinese are subverting our elections.
True, yeah.
But I think the problem that maybe she is up against, and I think a lot of people who are concerned about, the talk about wanting to sort of fan the flames again of these conflicts, are that the public is actually shifting away from being sympathetic to those views. So maybe there's a need to overcompensate. And I would sort of look back at polling data that shows, you know, hey, you know, 70% of South Koreans, you know, have basically said they agreed with President Moon's proposal to end the Korean War. And Americans are also, you know, pretty tired of the endless wars that have defined the past mm-hmm. two decades. You know, nearly two-thirds of Americans who are under 30, you know, believe the U.S. should respond to China's rise by decreasing U.S. troop presence in Asia, and that number is growing of Americans who feel that way. And a growing number of Americans also think the United States should make greater effort to engage in diplomacy as a leading component of U.S. foreign policy. Mm-hmm. So I think that that people like her and people who not just stand to potentially profit from great power competition, but genuinely probably believe that these countries are hell-bent on destroying not just the United States, but apparently South Korea as well, must look at that data, must look at the trends, look at the fact that, you know, look in the last presidential election, candidates like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, both of whom were very critical of, you know, the endless wars that have been waged by the United States. Say which will about either of those candidates. Yeah. You know, they both were consistent with that messaging. I think they see that, and it probably concerns them a great deal. Where I think things kind of go off the rails is that maybe they feel that the situation is getting so that they are losing control of the narrative to such a degree that it necessitates some really extreme, frankly absurd, types of messaging and outright lies.
A quick break from this podcast to recommend another podcast that you have to check out. It's called The Product Boss. It's hosted by Jacqueline and Mina. It's part of the HubSpot podcast network. If you have a physical product, this podcast is hyper tailored to you. It's going to help you take your business to the next level. In a recent episode, for example, they spoke about the power of TikTok for product businesses and how to use it to drive sales. And as somebody who is a little new to TikTok, I really learned some great tips for creating content that actually converts viewers into customers. They have a workshop style format that makes it really easy to follow along to take your business to the next level. So if you sell physical products, subscribe to The Product Boss wherever you get your podcast to unlock social media, marketing, and business strategies that create your dream business and then your dream life. Which is horrible, because as always with any fear, sometimes there's levels to whether or not that's valid or not. But I think you have to uncover like the truth in that particular fear. So for example, like in some parts of the world, I'm sure countries don't love the U.S., but other parts, I'm sure it's not as bad as we think it is. But when you do things like this, I feel like it polarizes people. It does exactly exactly what you said. It removes people's ability to think for themselves critically because the facts are so absurd. And it removes proper understanding of foreign policy because the foreign policy that's presented is so abstract and absurd and polarizing that you feel like that you have to go all the way to one end of the spectrum or the other, and that's where you have to sit, where the truth is probably like somewhere more in the middle, somewhere more moderate. Like, I'm sure
today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today's sponsor is BetterHelp. Now, hear me out. If you magically had an extra hour in a day, and I know sometimes that's the only time we get to ourselves, what would you do with it? Maybe you would catch up on sleep. Maybe you'd hit the gym. Maybe you'd finally get into that book that you've been eyeing. We're always wishing for more time. But what if we focused on how we use the time that we have? Think about what really lights you up. What would change in your life if you made that a priority? Do you even know what that thing is? Well, therapy has been a game changer for me, not because of some terrible thing that's happened to me, but because it's helped me figure out what matters, how to manage tough emotions, how to be a better friend, a partner, business person, and just really person all around. So if you're even a little curious about therapy, if you want to help think through what matters to you, what to prioritize, how to live your life, try BetterHelp. It's totally online and works around your crazy schedule. No awkward waiting rooms. Just get matched with a licensed therapist and start making the most of the time you've already got. Learn how to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/successpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/successpod.
I said this before, I don't think North Korea like loves the US, but I don't think China's relationship is as bad as definitely as North Korea's, definitely not. But I do believe that by having these types of campaigns, not only is it serving like a very selfish initiative, but also it removes people's ability to think for themselves well and critically. And that's the worst thing about it. It basically dumbs down the message to extreme opposites.
Exactly, and you're dumbing it down in a way that's so. And I think you just hit the nail on the head here. It's centered on fear,
which is horrible.
That when you look at what One Korea Network and KC Pack and sort of the network of Annie Chan is producing, it's telling people basically that their political identity, their cultural identity, their national identity is all under threat,
which is not true.
And it's coming from the Chinese and the North Koreans, and the only solution is to back, right-wing nationalists in both countries, and to oppose even the most innocuous attempts at diplomacy, and that's pretty concerning. Mm-hmm. Those are some dangerous threads that she's pulling on, and I think that I go back to the election conspiracy stuff. That's really disturbing to see that, she was pushing, and One Korea Network and other folks in her network were pushing theories about the election in South Korea that was before the US election in 2020. And that those conspiracy theories were ones that were later present in the United States. And I think we think that a lot of it, it's the United States, we kind of think in the insular way sometimes, and we think that these, crazy conspiracy theories about Chinese vote tampering are, entirely something produced by and for Americans for the American election, and that's where it came out of. And instead you see that, no, some of this was actually going on in South Korea earlier. A lot of these theories didn't just come out of nowhere. I'm not saying that, that they were, the same people running them in both countries, but it was absolutely in South Korea before the United States, some of those theories. And she was a very vocal person who was amplifying them. And I think that, it may explain to some degree the role with which, those became so prevalent here. To give an example, Trump's rally in Tulsa, in June of 2020, it got a lot of attention because Korean K-pop fans and teen users of TikTok bought all the tickets. It was really funny. Yeah. The Trump campaign thought that they were like going to have overflow. It was the first live event they were having.
Yeah, yeah.
After lockdowns from the pandemic, and they were like, they had like overflow capacity in the parking lot because they had like sold out three times over on the arena on the tickets. And then like nobody showed up because these K-pop and teens, K-pop fans and teens on TikTok bought all the tickets. It was hilarious. And even within the Trump campaign, there was there's emails that leaked out where they were talking about everyone knows what happened after the fact, at least. Except this woman who was publishing, in this letter she wrote to Donald Trump, she was claiming that actually this was the work of North Korean and Chinese intelligence. I mean, that type of a mindset,
like really, really out of touch
clearly
with reality.
She's applying that prism to everything that she's seen.
And that's very, very much out of touch with reality, but also very wealthy. And that's dangerous. That's very dangerous.
Absolutely. And you know, this, yeah, exactly. So what? I mean, so she has these crazy views. That's fine. You know, there's no shortage of people that probably hold these views, unfortunately. However, this is somebody who put, you know, around $1 million, probably now over $1 million into this effort. And that's where it starts to get a little bit scary. That, you know, how can this person who can bring these types of resources to bear be essentially a ghost, largely unknown, you know, welcomed onto the board of this Virginia, very close to Washington, D.C. based nuclear power company that has former diplomats, former senior military officials on it, involved in it. You know, that this is kind of disturbing, that you can see how the combination of money, some kind of radical views, and frankly, people just not paying a lot of attention to who's funding these things and what they're saying can let someone like that really move in a lot of different circles and start to seriously influence the policy debate.
So we understand the issue, and we understand what she did, and some of the reasons as to why she did it. But what's the solution? Like, what, like you're one journalist, and as much as you can pick one story at a time and one person to focus on at a time, that's a lot of work for one person. So how do we actually move the needle on this stuff? How do we create more exposure? How do we hold people accountable so that this doesn't poison the minds of people and doesn't create that fear? God knows we've had enough of it in the past 3 years. We don't need any more. So what do we do?
Well, you know, I think part of it is exposing ourselves to these stories, reading them, and recognizing that for every one of these stories that we do discover and hear about, there's probably a dozen more. I think it's the idea, and I think people are becoming attuned to the fact that dark money is actively involved in shaping the U.S. political debate. And I would hope that as we do that, it starts to make it something that sort of gatekeepers, as it were, at major institutions as well as in media start to pay attention to. And so I guess there's that answer, which is that I hope we're facing a cultural shift here. And I think that, you know, for the most part, people's skepticism about the role of money in politics has really been helpful in that respect. That when I write a story like this, I'm not just starting from scratch, explaining how, you know, people with moneyed interests may want to influence the political system in ways that are beneficial to them and actually detrimental to the majority of Americans, or in this case, people in South Korea as well. So I think there is that quality, that the more we see these stories, the more they get reported, the more we start to look at this with a critical eye. But I think there's another dimension here, and this is something that I've started to engage with more. I wrote a report last year about this, which is that, you know, we do need to have some ethical standards in the institutions in Washington, D.C. that oftentimes shape the foreign policy debate, and the policy debate more broadly, because most think tanks don't just do foreign policy. And that's that, as we were going back to earlier, the think tanks really need to implement certain fundamental transparency standards, which means showing who your funders are would be a major one. And I will say that there has been there's a really good trend with that, which is that I'd say in the past 10 years, the vast majority of think tanks in Washington, especially of the big ones, are disclosing their funding. And that's a huge, huge, huge positive development. To be, as I was saying earlier, they don't have, their legal status is that they are a 501c3, which is a nonprofit that has no obligation to disclose their funders. So they need to voluntarily do it, and they are. Second, I would like to see them actually comply with the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which in sort of broad terms is a law we have in the United States, which says that, you know, if you're acting as the agent of a foreign principal, you need to disclose that.
And what does that mean exactly, though? Because in this particular case, that wasn't the case. She's a resident of Hawaii, so she's not even a foreign agent.
In her case, it wouldn't have mattered. But in terms of the foreign policy debate more broadly, it goes on. It's pretty prevalent. You know, that we have think tanks that are taking foreign money, and they produce content that is designed to influence policy. And often that is, you know, part of conditional grants given to them by foreign governments. And they basically have refused to disclose that under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. So it's also complying with the law. would I think help a lot with how the debate is conducted. And finally, and I think this does kind of go back to somebody like Annie Chan, the idea of a conflict of interest is something that most people understand. And Annie Chan has a big one, which is that she was a board member of a company that stood to benefit financially, and it talked about how it would benefit from great power competition, as they call it, with Russia and China. And the work that she was actively involved in producing at One Korea Network and at KCPAC was pretty explicitly about furthering that agenda. You know, pushing out crazy conspiracy theories about the role of China, pushing out the idea that even the nuclear power was part of a solution to that competition and would give the United States an advantage. That's actually stuff that they published at One Korea Network, while never disclosing that the chair of this organization and this news outlet had potentially an opportunity to profit from that argument and those policies that would come from it. And I think that starting to have an open conversation about conflict of interest is probably the most important thing we can do. And it's something that folks, again, in foreign policy have been anathema to. And I think in other policy areas, there's a little more awareness of it. And I think that this is just a glaring example of somebody who stood to make a lot of money potentially from bringing out some of the worst policies that we could come up with, prolonging a war that a lot of Americans think we need to end, and that a lot of people in South Korea would like to see come to an end as well. I mean, endless war on the Korean Peninsula is really not in very many people's interest.
Of course, no. Yeah.
Maybe for Annie Chan and her business associates, it was.
And maybe just help me understand, like I probably should have asked this a bit earlier, but when you say that she puts up a billboard in Times Square and she spends about $1 million, even that seems inconsequential in the grand scheme of things. Like, can you change an entire country's perspective on a particular thing with a $1 million budget? Because I know how much it would cost to reach that many people repeatedly to actually influence. So it doesn't need to be a lot more than that, or is this significant?
In the foreign policy debate, it's significant. And I think this is a great example, actually, of why it's significant. Because a lot of the time that we're talking about, when you think about the budgets that are required to move policy, generally we're talking about policy areas where there's a lot of attention on it, where it's already in the media, where it's already top of mind for a lot of Americans, and where there are very well-defined parties pushing on both sides. So that's a very expensive competition to be involved in. The most expensive example would be American presidential elections, where $1 billion is kind of where the budget is headed towards for some of these campaigns. It's incredibly costly, partially because it's contested. And I think in this example, it's a good example of where these were advertisements that were targeting specific members of Congress, doing so to try to reach out, I think, to Korean Americans and get them to call their members of Congress. How many Korean American members of Congress call any given member on a day with a specific policy ask about a piece of legislation involving video calls with to North
not
Korea?
Many.
Not many. You don't need to mobilize a lot of people. If you can make some noise, if you can scare some people, if you can mobilize them, you're going to be moving them to press on a member of Congress where foreign policy is definitely not their top priority, because I don't think there's a single congressional race that is determined by foreign policy. So this is not generally a top issue for a member of Congress. It's not generally a top issue for a voter. And if you can get in there and apply a little bit of pressure and make people a little bit uncomfortable, there is definitely a possibility that you can have outsized impact. So I think one of the reasons that relatively small sums of money can make a big difference in foreign policy is that while objectively the stakes are high, it's matters of war and peace often, the number of actors are limited, the target audience is limited, the number of people paying attention is limited, and all of that can mean that the total costs don't have to be that high.
So that's even scarier, to be honest.
It is scarier. Exactly. It makes it just ripe for people like Annie Chan and people who have pretty radical views on foreign policy to say, hey, you know what? Maybe there's a number of different policy areas that I have an interest in. And if I want to make the biggest bang for my buck that I can, foreign policy might be where it's at.
Has she been held accountable for anything since your story has been published? Has there been any action taken at all?
She's been removed. She appears to have been removed from the board of the nuclear company.
Interesting.
They've deleted her photo, name, and profile from their website.
Okay. Well, that's something.
They're not responding to me when I've asked about what happened.
One of the points in the article that I thought was interesting, just to provide a little bit of context about how big this issue is, you mentioned Chan appears to be borrowing from a well-worn playbook in her efforts to inject money into the U.S. political system to generate personal profits while also influencing elite opinion to steer foreign policy in militaristic direction in East Asia. How often does stuff like this happen for people that aren't aware?
It happens often, and it happens at the upper echelons of political funding. I think the best example that I point to is the late Sheldon Adelson, who was the top funder of the Republican Party. He was so for many election cycles. And the coverage of his giving to again, I'm going to bring in my media criticism here, of his political giving was people, that there would be every single election cycle, he and his wife, Miriam, who is going to continue to give apparently at a high level in the Republican Party. And the two of them, to be clear, were the biggest funders of not just the presidential races, but also congressional races for the Republican Party. And there would always be these speculations about why do they give their money? And they would say, well, you know, hey, they have interest in the gaming industry. You know, they have one of the biggest casino firms in the United States and in Macau. And, you know, well, maybe they care about gaming regulation. It's a possibility. Another speculation was that maybe they did it because they wanted to get the estate tax lowered so they could pass on more money to their children, which is a possibility. All totally fair speculations for people, somebody who was worth, you know, tens of billions of dollars. But we never talked about, or at least the mainstream media never really gave too much credence to the fact that he had actually been pretty clear about why he gave the money, which was foreign policy. And it was about, you know, maintaining U.S. support, not just for Israel, but for Israel's, you know, right-wing Likud party. In some pretty radical respects, Sheldon Adelson had talked about that he thought that the U.S. negotiating position with Iran should be to drop a nuclear weapon in the Iranian desert, as he put it, and tell them that the second one is going to fall on Tehran if they don't give up their nuclear program. These are people who went on to lobby for the release of Jonathan Pollard, a convicted spy that the U.S. intelligence agencies had been very adamant should not be released. And certainly the terms of his parole when he was let out of prison shouldn't let him leave the country. And the Adelsons actively, you know, were very open about the fact they were lobbying for his release and for his parole to be lifted so he could leave the United States. He was spied for Israel, and they flew him on one of their private planes to Israel in the last days of the Trump administration. So they did these things openly. You know, they talked about it. Newt Gingrich, who was a recipient of their money, said, you know, their top issue is foreign policy, and it's about, you know, maintaining U.S. support for Israel. So I think it happens at the top levels of the party. And we saw during the Iran nuclear deal debate in 2015 that, you know, the Republican Party fell in line effectively with where Sheldon Adelson was because he funded every single one of their campaigns. And we saw it in the presidential election in 2016 when Donald Trump, after saying initially that he was not going to take Sheldon Adelson's money and that he was really thought the United States should be a neutral arbiter in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and his main complaint about the Iran nuclear deal was that Iran wasn't buying too many Airbus planes and not enough Boeing planes, turned around and said, you know, after he won the nomination and he needed to shuttle out Sheldon Adelson's money, he reversed course on all of that, ended up abrogating from the nuclear deal. Very much at Adelson's encouragement. So to go back to sort of where I concluded with that story about, you know, that this is a strategy that has been utilized a great deal. And I think it happens at the top level of the political process, again, because there's not a lot of scrutiny about it. People don't pay as much attention as they should to foreign policy, and money talks. Mm-hmm. It works. it really works. And I think people like Sheldon Adelson, and to maybe, you know, in a more limited model to looking at somebody like Annie Chan, they know what they're doing. And they know that we see these sums of money and say, how could you shift U.S. foreign policy with it? And they would say, well, because I did.
Quite easily, yeah.
Yeah, and again, you look at Sheldon Adelson, I think he shapes the Republican Party. It shaped, because he died last year. But he shaped the Republican Party's foreign policy platform quite effectively. And people openly, it's not a secret that he did this.
To wrap this up, because I want to go into some rapid fire just to close it out, just to pull it from your insights. But with your work and what you've done over your career and some of the things you've exposed and investigated, what do you hope you will accomplish or you'll be able to accomplish in your career? What do you want your legacy to be when people speak about your work in 100 years from now? What do you want them to say?
It's not the sexy answer, but
there is no sexy answer. The answer is whatever you want it to be. That's important.
I want to normalize the foreign policy debate.
Okay.
I think it should be normal. I think we should. It's okay if it's partisan. It's okay if people have different views. It's okay if people want different outcomes. But let's stop pretending that it's something else. Let's stop pretending that the adults are in the room and they all want the same outcome and they're all pulling in the same direction. And the differences are really just differences of how we're going to execute on this. It's not a matter of wanting different outcomes. It's unhealthy. It gets you bad policy. I think it tends to steer the United States towards not questioning the mistakes that it's made in the past. And frankly, I think it leads toward the United States being involved in endless wars if you're not willing to question the policies you've pursued.
No, it's very smart.
So I think normalizing that debate, broadening it so you can bring in more voices, getting rid of some of the gatekeepers on it, and acknowledging that, hey, there's moneyed interests here. There's foreign interests here. There's people who want conflict because it happens to be good for their bottom line. You know, the weapons firms do not want peace. Annie Chan does not want peace. She is very clear. She's involved in a business that wants great power competition. I don't think you should outlaw that.
But people should know it.
But I think we should be able to at least we should know it and we should talk about it, you know, and not pretend that this is a very clean space that's somehow different than other dimensions of U.S. political debate.
If people want to connect with you, where should they go? All the social, website, all that stuff.
Social is Eli Clifton on Twitter. Check me out there. I publish at responsiblestatecraft.org, which is the publication of the Quincy Institute, which I was involved in founding. I'm very proud of it. It's an awesome think tank that tries to promote policies that will have the United States engaging with the rest of the world with vigorous diplomacy instead of with endless war. I like to think that we're part of normalizing that political debate.
Amazing. Okay, good. All right, let's do a couple of rapid fire to close this out. So biggest challenge.
Perfect.
Biggest challenge you've overcome in your own personal life. What was it? How'd you overcome it? What'd you learn from it?
That's a good one. The biggest challenge. Writing things that I thought were meaningful that nobody found interesting. I think that's actually the biggest challenge in my work and the thing that made me want to just give up on it sometimes is when you think you have something meaningful to say and you think you've done some interesting research and it's just not something that others see as meaningful. And I know that's sort of a broad thing. It's not specific anecdote,
any creator.
But it's the biggest challenge as a journalist is like, you know, when you feel like you're just banging your head against a wall.
How do you keep going? Like what drives you? Where do you find that motivation to write the next one?
It's the hope that the next one will redeem that. You know, it's that hope that you know, it's being a gambler to some degree, right? It's that you want that dopamine hit and it's, well, maybe I missed. Maybe I didn't tell the story the right way. Maybe there was nothing I could do and I just picked the wrong story to tell. But it's the wanting to redeem oneself from the stories that didn't hit.
If you had to choose one person, obviously there's been many, but pick one person who's had a major impact on your career, on your life. Who was it? What did they teach you?
Oof, one person. I mean, I would have to give credit to Jim Loeb, who you know, was the first person to give me an opportunity to do journalism. He was the bureau chief in Washington, D.C. at Interpress Service. And he encouraged me to go to those think tanks and not just start writing up the reports and the press releases verbatim and start to dig into who was behind this, who was paying for it, who was financing it.
If you had to recommend a book or a podcast, something that's impacted your life.
A book or a podcast. I'm far more drawn. I mean, I listen to a variety of podcasts, but I do think that books have, you know, a timeless element to them. So I guess there's a few that really do jump out at me. Dark Money is just an incredible one.
What's it about? Just so people know
that it's about the role of dark money by Jane Mayer, and she digs into the networks that have funded American political debate in ways that that shape policy outcomes that affect everyday Americans. And I think it's very, very powerful. Other books that have really that have done so much for, I think, shaping my worldview would be King Leopold's Ghost, which is amazing. The story of the Belgian Congo, again, of how decisions made a continent away can impact the lives of so many people on the other side of the world. And finally, I would point to Steve Cole's books, Ghost Wars, the Bin Ladens, which offer a degree of detail and storytelling about the endless wars, especially in Afghanistan, but also Al-Qaeda and the global war on terror, in a way that I can't recommend highly enough. You know, that just you feel like you're there for events that are occurring. You feel like you get to understand the ins and outs of the Bin Laden family and about Al-Qaeda and about the U.S. war in Afghanistan in ways that I think if more people had understood it at that level, we probably wouldn't have engaged in 2 decades of endless wars and failed nation building.
Very good. If you could tell your 20-year-old self one thing, what would it be?
Piss more people off. It's fun.
And love that.
For the most part, it pays dividends. You know, the journalism that gets you those angry phone calls, the number of times you get told you'll never work in this town again are all badges of honor. And I love those phone calls.
And last question.
I've learned to love those phone calls. I've learned to love those phone calls.
I think
calls.
You have to have it. I think when you expose people or when you bring things to light, you have to have tough skin. It's not easy. It's not easy at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I used to actually, despite the fact that I love the research and I love exposing things, I used to dread those calls and those emails. And now it's the opposite. Now I look forward to them.
And last question, what does success mean to you?
Success to me means getting to do what one loves. You know, you only have one life, and I'm very, very fortunate that I've gotten to do things that I find meaningful and that I really enjoy. And I think that that's a privilege that probably most people don't get to have. And you know, every day that I'm doing what I'm doing, I'm just incredibly grateful that I get to do it. I think a lot of times in journalism, you know, it's there's not a lot of jobs out there. And every time I see somebody that's good at it, get that opportunity, I always, you know, write them that email that's, you know, hey, you know, congratulations. But, you know, also just, you know, just remember, this is incredible. You know, most people don't get to do this.
I agree. Good.
And it's pretty cool when you get to.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.